The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly. I'm Ollie Mann. Today we shelve into the payrolls. Today we delve into the perils of autocomplete technology, the apps that make texting your grandma ever more convenient, even if that means selling off to giant corporations everything you've ever said. As emoji becomes Britain's fastest growing form of communication, smiley face, and new startup Crystal claims they'll help us write more empathetic emails, skeptical face, I'll be asking, is this new tech really transforming our communications for the better, or are we at risk of becoming predictable drones? Tortured face, doing Edvard Munch's scream. To help me decide is Evan Sellinger, a professor of philosophy who thinks the divide between the human and the algorithm is getting dangerously blurred, and also Professor Viv Evans, a linguist, looking at how emoji might be making us better at communicating emotion. Sad face. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Well, from autocorrect to autocomplete, all alleged improvements in human-computer interactivity are designed to prevent us sending embarrassing emails to the boss. Yet, as we all know, often this tech actually makes our communications far more offensive. Which might be why Google recently rolled out their undo send feature across Gmail. You now have up to 30 seconds after pressing send to read over what you've actually sent and recall it if you need to. Well, joining me now from the tech team are Alex Hearn and Hannah Jane Parkinson. And Hannah, you recently wrote a piece about the worst email fails, or the best, I suppose, depending on your point of view, that Google can now deliver us from. What are some of the worst offenders?
What was brilliant about this piece is that I didn't actually have to do a lot of research into it because it's so frequent that I just went on a lot of experiences with my close friends. And we had one of the best ones was my friend who used to work for an MP and emailed her boss saying, and I have the line here, she said, "Thanks for your help. I know how busty you are," in her email instead of busy. And then even worse was someone who got their G&T keys mixed up, who was a friend of my sister, who signed off with King Retards instead of Kind Regards. Oh. And I promise you that is true. And she works in a kind of like diversity branch for a local council.
See, but in both of those examples, the recipient, I think, could be trusted to guess what had happened there, no?
I mean, I would hope so. But also, we're just going to quickly out our boss, Jemima, who is very awful at this as well and does it kind of all the time.
It's actually become sort of a lovely cryptic crossword every morning where you get the morning email sent from her iPhone on the train and you'll play a fun little game of trying to reverse engineer what she's actually talking about. It's because the thing about autocorrect, obviously, is it's although what you were doing in the intro is often what you get, where there are words that sound alike or look alike. Sometimes the algorithm decides that every single key you pressed was wrong and you get a word which is absolutely visually distinct from the actual thing. So, yeah. You know, it's like a good crossword.
But yeah, she emailed Julia Powles, who is one of our writers, over the weekend. And her saying that she hoped that Julia had a reproductive weekend rather than productive weekend. So that's like a typical Jemimaism.
She could have done with the undo send feature.
Okay, and this feature actually, it's been on Gmail for years, hasn't it? I've had it for years, but they've now rolled it out front and center of people's Gmail experience, whether they want it or not. Is that a sign that this problem is actually very common indeed and we still need solutions? Or is it that people do muddle through and you do find it kind of funny and it doesn't really matter if there's a spelling mistake on your email?
I mean, we were kind of surprised that people didn't know about this feature actually when it was.
It saved my life. I think it's not the spelling mistakes. It's the emails written in fury or grief that are the real ones that you want to take back, because there are emails where you write them and it feels so good to write them and it feels so good to send them, and then 5 seconds after it feels so bad to have done both of those. And being able to go, you know what? No, let's backtrack.
It'd be great if it worked on GChat, because, you know, that's one of the
This is the other problem, isn't it? If you start getting too used to it and then end up on an email client that doesn't have it, just merrily sending your angry email, I'll take it back. Oh, no, I can't take it back. That's out there in the ether forever.
But then there's sort of saving you from yourself, isn't there, in terms of your emotions? And then there's using technology to actually predict what you might have wanted to say before you even say it. And we'll be moving on to that shortly. But do you think there's a danger here that, you know, first people get accustomed to the idea that technology will tell them what they didn't mean to say, and then we're going to end up in a situation where it's telling us what to say?
It's already does that. It's brilliant. Because I can spend more time focusing on Netrunner. It's marvelous. Netrunner and craft beers. The computer takes up, you know, writing articles for The Guardian. My articles are not algorithmically generated.
Yes,
yet.
Yeah. You're laughing all the way to redundancy. Well, someone who's rather more sceptical of all of this datafication is Evan Selinger, who's a professor of philosophy at Rochester Institute of Technology. He's been looking into a new app called Crystal, which is quite a controversial development. Evan, you're there now. Hi there.
Hey.
Explain to us briefly what Crystal is, what it's promising to do, and why you think it's all deeply odd.
So yeah, Crystal is a new app, and for me, the issue is not so much how well it particularly works. I think it's a sign of really what's to come. So here's what Crystal promises. The gist is, it says, look, you know, people are overloaded with communication, and if you don't communicate effectively in the workplace and beyond, chances are you're wasting time and not getting things done. So their solution really has two steps. They say, look, there's tons of data out there on, you know, who people are and what they like and how they want to be spoken to. You know, we've got our data trails on social media, on LinkedIn, all over the place. And so what Crystal does is essentially it aggregates all of that information and combines it into a personality profile. So it can tell you things, supposedly, about whether people like fancy introductions, dear so-and-so, or they want you to cut to the chase, whether they like, you know, quick anecdotes or sort of long, detailed, thoughtful missives. And so what Crystal essentially does is it tells you how people want to be communicated with, and then it goes further, right? Depending on like which version of it you use, you can go beyond the profile and it can integrate with an email platform. So if there is a sense that a person wants you to cut to the chase and you didn't quite pick up on that in the profile that it gave you, it can nudge your actual writing. So if I write, you know, hey, Alex, how's it going? It might let me know that the hi bit is too much or hi Alex. Maybe I should just cut to the chase and say, what time does this podcast start? So that's sort of what it's all about. And the people who've created it, their big push is this is supposed to make communication more empathetic, right? If we can speak to people the way that they want to be spoken to, I guess there will be less hurt feelings and sort of better flow all around. So that's sort of the rosy depiction of what this platform is.
So it helps you write more efficient emails in business. What's not to like about that?
I mean, don't get me wrong, right? We are all overloaded. Our inboxes are overflowing. But I think there is more than meets the eye. And it's not a question of whether this is just good or just bad. For me, the issue is how complicated it is and whether if we start using technologies like that, we'll really have a full understanding of exactly what we're doing. So there's a couple of issues. I mean, beyond the wealth of privacy problems, and I think those are numerous, including the fact that a lot of information that many people haven't been expecting to be aggregated together in that way, suddenly at the push of a button can be used in very manipulative fashion. Beyond those privacy issues, I think really it begs the question of, do we really need to have predictive technology in order to make us empathetic? I mean, I often think of empathetic as something like being attuned to other people. And if the guiding premise is, well, how can you be attuned if you don't really know what the other person's about? That's often something that's revealed in a kind of give and take through conversation, through dialogue. So the point that they're trying to give is attunement isn't something you're supposed to in a way that stems from you figure out. Let us figure that out for you and let us nudge the communication in a very formulaic way, because it's not supposed to be your judgment anymore about what's appropriate. The whole point of this, to really make it efficient, is that the algorithms know better than you do not only what the other person wants, but exactly how you should speak. And so that fine line between who is doing the speaking, is it you? Is it the algorithm? This is, I think, effectively blurring that in a fairly profound way if the algorithms become popular and people believe that they get it right.
But people could have said similar things, couldn't they, when all kinds of new technology came out, predictive text in the first place, for example, you could have said was reading our minds and sharing information. Actually, most people do just find it helpful.
Sure, but I think we need to differentiate a couple things. So first of all, when it comes to actually the predictive text that we have around, it's very easy to be fairly unconcerned about it. I mean, you know, Apple really hyped up QuickType. This was going to be something that could, you know, go through our data channels. It could be context specific, know how you want to communicate to your boss and to your best friend and to your wife. And, you know, most of us find it, you know, slightly helpful at best, often awkward. But the issue, if we're looking ahead, isn't contained by the technological limitations right now. So yes, you know, using something like QuickType isn't going to affect things in a profound way. But for me, the question becomes, what happens when these things get really good? What happens when it's not glitchy? What happens when it's very seductive to use? And so I would want to take a step back and think of a couple things. Like, first of all, on a very basic level, I mean, I think language is crucial to us being human, right? We can't read other people's minds. They can't directly peer in ours, right? Verbal communication is important, and so is body language. But writing for us is so crucial to figure out what folks are thinking and what they're feeling and what they're hoping for. I mean, that's why the famous Turing test revolved around written conversation, right? The idea was that if a machine could keep up with us in written conversation, maybe we should call it intelligent. Maybe it's so smart it gets our human form of life. And language has always been crucial to identity, right? Personal identity and culture, right? How we speak tells a lot about where we're from and what kinds of experiences we've had, what we read and what we watch. What we're looking at are systems that are trying to put us not so much in the driver's seat, but in the back seat, so that algorithms are sort of figuring out what we're about and how we should speak. I think that's potentially a very big game changer, not just in how we communicate, but how we even conceive of who we are as communicators.
Okay, I mean, Evan, you're a philosophy professor. It's kind of, you know, comes along with your job title to think about these things on a grand scale and their long-term effects. Hannah, you've been listening to all of that. Do you think in broad strokes this will, or this kind of technology will end up with all our communications being influenced in this negative way by technology? Or as people, are we going to be able to say, well, that's a business email. We want that to be optimized, but we still have poetry. We still have love letters.
What was in that? There was something in that piece actually that we just discussed about where someone sent a global email around about a missing fruit bowl, which is probably not something that you should send around the office, but it was just, it was this like collision of worlds where it was absolutely not an efficient kind of business email, but it was hilarious and a lot of the office had kind of fun.
Yeah, so humor is an issue, isn't it, Alex? You know, computers are never going to be able to keep up, or we think computers will never keep up with our levels of humor. Do you think that's...
This is kind of what I wanted to jump in. So there's a lot of whether or not they can do this is sort of is a question that we're kind of leaping over. I get that the obvious thing to do, especially if you're trying to look at the philosophical implications of something, is to leap to the end. But right now, it shouldn't be overstated quite how bad these systems are. Like, I haven't used Crystal. I do, however, use SwiftKey, which does a similar thing. It's a keyboard replacement for Android and iOS, which promises to analyze your emails, tweets, texts, your whole corpus of written language, come up with a model for how you communicate, and then offer text predictions to you. And the problem is, that's kind of it. Basically, what that works out in practice is most of the time, you'll get recommended the same three words that it would recommend everyone else. And most of the time, those words are either incredibly obvious because you type the comfortab of comfortable, and yep, you get offered comfortable and comfortably, and that doesn't really tell you much. Or you get offered three words that you're not going to use at all. Every now and again, you'll see a little bit of yourself poking through, but it absolutely does not at this stage feel like it's reading your mind or presenting an uncanny vision of yourself back to you. And I think it's actually important to accept that in the analysis of it, to go, okay, well, while we're talking about what these things could do, let's also bear in mind the fact that right now they can't do much, that tech is a sector which overpromises and underdelivers quite a lot, increasingly so these days, I feel, you know. everything from voice recognition through to Google Now, which promises to read all your emails and present you with context-specific information and actually just gives you the time of the bus stop that you're next to.
But Evan, I mean, actually, voice identification is one of the things that has got better, as Alex says, and that is because people haven't kicked up too much of a fuss about the things they're saying being beamed back to Apple and Amazon and Microsoft. So your fear is people won't realize what they're stepping into and then it'll be too late to paddle back.
Well, I don't want to put it in terms of, you know, fear and gloom and doom. I mean, I actually think Alex is saying incredibly smart things. I think the issue, though, comes to how you want to frame it, right? You could always begin with where things currently are with the state of the art. But we are seeing so much growth in so many areas of information and communication technology. And the mediation of our communication through these sort of proprietary platforms is exploding. So for me, I think if we want to know what kind of world to build, maybe that's a slightly different question than where is the technology going to be in 5 or 10 years, the issue has to be, what do we value about different kinds of communication, and when would we find those values somewhat encroached? I mean, if you compare with it, I think here's just a good way to think about it. I mean, if I really want to be philosophical, like a long time ago, this great French philosopher named Merleau-Ponty, he had a great distinction. He said, let's think about the difference between spoken speech and authentic speech. And it came down to this. Spoken speech, that's sort of formulaic expression, right? You know, our words roll off the tongue, or we quickly type things on our fingers. And when we do this, we don't want to fuss. We don't want to think a lot about, is this the right noun or the right verb? Does this really capture what we're thinking? Right? Good enough communication suffices. This is sort of cookie cutter expression. And the fact is, we need that a lot. It's not like Merleau-Ponty said, no, this is terrible, right? But that's not the only mode of our communication. I mean, he also points out we do have this thing called authentic speech that is something creative. It's when we're still thinking something through, something nuanced, maybe something deeply personalized. We don't know in advance what we're going to say. Language isn't capturing what's in our head. It's rather the conversation itself makes it clear what we wanted to say at the very end. And I think we need to ask ourselves, as we're using these proprietary platforms that have very good financial incentives for us to speak in boxes and checks, is that really, by and large, what we want?
And I think also what's quite interesting about Crystal is it isn't just about the person who's using the app saying, I want to opt into this service that's going to help me write better emails. It is saying, I want to target this particular business person by the detritus of information about them all over the internet. Tell me how to target them better. And of course, that person hasn't opted in. They've just had their communications out there on the web, and suddenly there are apps out there looking to commercialize how to target them. That is quite insidious, isn't it?
From a privacy perspective, I really worry about this. And this has a lot to do with the fact that we haven't come to grips, I think, particularly in the States. I'm not sure if things are all that much better necessarily over in Europe, with that issue of what Woody Herzog and I call obscurity. In some sense, a lot of that information is publicly available. And at least in the United States, there's a growing sense that you don't have any privacy interests in public declarations. But you've hit the nail on the head with your question. People are not expecting those public declarations to be so ripped out of context that they can be sort of assembled in a powerful profile that can be integrated with essentially a manipulative platform. And so I definitely think we have some privacy interests in that. I think there's something very disconcerting about that. But in order to point that out, right now the companies certainly have the legal ground, and people need to sort of mount a case about why, just because some of that was found in LinkedIn or maybe a public declaration on social media, it's not necessarily okay to assemble them in these ways that we're unaware of and that might have profound implications about how we're responding to the way that people are addressing us.
And Evan Selinger, if I wanted to write to you to thank you for your contribution, but I didn't want to have to try Crystal to do it, what kind of email style would you respond to?
I don't know. I mean, maybe this is always the thing, right? I don't know if I have a particular style. I think it's very much case by case. So, I mean, people should write to me the way that they think conveys how they are. And if we go back and forth a couple times, I think it'll become clear what I like and whether that sort of meets up.
Okay, so long-winded and individualistic. Got it. Okay, thanks, Evan.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you run a mobile business, you need a payment solution that's simple, safe, and seamless. With Braintree, you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards, and more across any platform. With superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts, it's the full-stack payment solution for your business. To learn more and for your first £30,000 of transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com.
Grinny man, smiley poo, deep fried prawn, English flag, banknote, thumbs up. That translated means emoji is now the fastest growing form of communication in the UK, although arguably still not the best in audio form. Maybe we need to work out a number of sound effects. Well, Professor Viv Evans is a linguist from Bangor University. He's been studying the use of emoji. Hi there, Viv.
Hello there.
Is it technically a real language? People talk about emoji as if it's a language, but you say no, it's a form of communication.
Yes, it's a form of communication. It's not a language. So the definitional quality of a language is that, first of all, it has a relatively sophisticated semantic range. So if you think about a language like English, for instance, the active vocabulary of depending on background education and so on is anything between 30 to 60 or 70,000 words, and then the passive vocabulary, so the words that someone would recognise, would be significantly greater. And obviously, a large vocabulary is required in order to express the complexities and sophistications of the sorts of things we wish to express. Now, the second thing that a language requires is a syntax, so a grammar system that allows us to combine the vocabulary to make well-formed utterances and to be able to deploy the words in order to express things, anything from declarations of undying love to idle comments on the weather.
And yet the reason that people, I suppose, say that it is a language or talk about it in those terms, and I guess the reason why you're studying it at university as a linguist, is because people say, particularly sort of the young generation in Britain at the moment, you know, they're not remembering anymore how to correctly structure something grammatically when they're writing. They're only able to communicate through emoji. Is that really true? Is that really happening?
No, I don't think that's the case. There's a lot of prejudice against emoji. What emoji basically is doing is rounding out a communicative complex that is in existence in spoken communication, but hitherto has not been there in digital communication. So just to give you a sort of an analogy, thinking about spoken language, what we do when we communicate is a lot of the message, a lot of the meaning isn't strictly speaking coming from the words and the way we're combining the words. Obviously a lot is, but meaning is much more than that. So for example, intonation, which obviously goes part and parcel with spoken language, spoken communication, is in fact changing the meaning of the words. And it's not just intonation that's key to meaning construction when we use language every day. Gesture is an important feature as well. So scientists now know that if you try and suppress gestures artificially, for example, in lab settings, then what actually happens is that spoken language becomes less fluent. And what emoji does, what emoji is doing, in effect, is filling in our ability to decipher tone and so on. The things, exactly those things that come through in the spoken channel from things like gesture, intonation and so on.
But then, a pink heart, that clearly means I love you. A cat with hearts for eyes or a steaming turd, it's got into a pretty weird world, hasn't it, Alex? Emoji has developed in ways that people wouldn't have predicted, I think.
Sure, but actually there's something I quite like about what you just said, because at the beginning of the show you referred to a smiley poo. Now you referred to a stinking turd. What that is the smiley poo is the way Apple and Apple devices render the glyph pile of poo, I think it's described in the standard, and a steaming turd is the way that Google devices do it. So you've got this weird thing, which I can't think of any other communications medium which happens, where things can be quite literally lost in translation. You know, is how does that play at all into your research, Viv? I mean, in its own way, it's kind of analogous to stripping out the nuance when you send written communication.
Sure. I mean, this is a software issue, and obviously there is different rendering across different platforms. Unicode, the consortium that establishes the international standard, sort of sets parameters of how things should appear, and that's obviously important, so that you do get things rendered in an analogous way. But I think that's a separate issue from you know, the function of emoji, how it's being used. That's the thing that I'm most interested in, because I think it's incredibly interesting in terms of how communication is evolving. Human communication has been evolving for the last 2.8 million years. And this is the latest chapter, I think.
It's quite interesting because, I mean, you brought up Unicode, which is the international body which chooses what the glyphs in emoji are. You bringing that up in a context of evolution, I mean, this isn't evolution. This is intelligent design. Unicode, to what extent are they actively shaping the language? They say they're reactive. They say they listen to appeals from the community. But, like, by and large, what they say goes. There is no taco emoji because Unicode decided to push that off to the next release. You know, are they actively shaping language in a way that no other body has been given the power to do ever before?
Right. I mean, in a sense, they are. I mean, emoji is quite different from natural language, so a language like English. So in a language like English, we as individual language users have a vested interest, and if you want to think about it in these sorts of terms, a superpower in the sense that we can innovate. So a natural language is something that evolves. Individual people, speakers, are able to change it, and then the innovations that are successful get propagated through a language community, which leads to, over time, to spectacular change. Emoji is clearly different from that.
For this to truly become, you know, a dominant nuance in communication, it's got to be something that you can use in a business platform, something that you can use in a Dear John letter, something that you can use in a will. Do you think it's ever going to evolve into that kind of level of communication?
I completely agree. For this to develop in terms of its register, so to become more formal, if you like, and to be taken up in professional settings, probably what does need to happen is that a different register of emoji needs to be developed. That's more acceptable, visually acceptable in terms of a workplace context.
Viv, can you give us one example of what an emoji in a professional environment that would be acceptable would look like?
Sadly, I'm not a graphic designer or a visual designer. You know, the point that was made earlier, I think Alex made the point about the smiling poo. You know, that probably would not be appropriate just because of kind of the context. But even things like smiley faces and so on need to probably be adapted so that they look a bit more professional.
Well, I don't know, smiley poo, briefcase, paperclip, coffee cup. I'll meet you for a meeting in the cafe in front of the sewer.
Cool.
I think it could work. But obviously we couldn't go to the taco restaurant, as Alex pointed out earlier. Professor Viv Evans, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And before we wrap up, Alex, you were explaining an amusing emoji fact to me just a moment ago.
Yeah, in emoji news.
Yes. hashtag emoji news.
Hashtag emoji news.
Lol.
Instagram allows you to search for hashtags on its service. So yeah. You can search for hashtag sun, hashtag sand, hashtag sea. And you can even search for hashtag emoji. So you can search for hashtag cash emoji and you get a lot of piles of money. Hashtag pistol emoji shows you Americans showing off with their guns.
I sense there's a butt coming.
Yeah. Hashtag aubergine emoji. That one's manually filtered by Instagram. It shows no results because the aubergine emoji on Apple platforms doesn't really look like an emoji.
No.
It looks like male genitalia.
It is the most phallic of the available vegetables.
So if you were
By the way, we're talking about an eggplant for American
An
listeners.
Eggplant, an yes. aubergine. So if you were to be able to perform a search for the eggplant emoji, you would get a lot of not safe for work pictures.
Yeah.
So you can't.
Okay, good to know. I know exactly what I'm going to try and do immediately after this, just out of curiosity. Thank you, Alex. Thank you to Hannah as well. And of course, to Evan Sellinger and Professor Viv Evans. I've been Ollie Mann. Do follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Ollie with a Y, MANN, the producer, Alana Chance. And you don't need predictive software to know there will be another Tech Weekly podcast next week. Smiley face. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.